I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. No one disagrees that it's a serious conflict, but the question now is the Iraq War a civil war? The Bush administration says no, but the chorus of those who say yes is growing. Today, NBC News announced its decision to call the conflict a civil war on the Today Show. Here's Matt Lauer addressing retired Army four-star General Barry McCaffrey.
We should mention, we didn't just wake up on a Monday morning and say, let's call this a civil war. This took careful deliberation. We consulted with a lot of people. You were one of the people we talked to.
And General McCaffrey joins us now. General, you discussed your reasoning on the Today Show. Can you tell us how you made your decision?
Well, I've been calling it a civil war low grade for the past 18 months or 2 years. There are two huge factions struggling this, Sunni versus Shia Arab. Thousands are being killed. Hundreds of thousands are in flight as refugees or leaving the country. They're employing heavy weapons, mortars, heavy machine guns, and it's a struggle for power and survival in the post-U.S. Iraq.
We're going to be speaking to a scholar in a moment, but we understand there's a scholarly definition of a civil war. There have to be at least two warring parties from the same country, and at least 1,000 people killed in total, at least 100 from each side. You feel it, obviously, it meets that criteria.
Oh, for gosh sakes, there are more than 3,000 killed last month. You know, I think one of the challenges is this is domestic political nonsense. If we don't label things as they are, if we don't face reality, we're going to have a hard time struggling to overcome it. There are also clearly criminal elements at work throughout the country. Governance has broken down. There's a foreign jihadist element. There's a Sunni insurgency against the coalition foreign occupier element. But the heart of the matter is, it's a struggle for power in Iraq.
Well, now you say there's some domestic political nonsense. The Bush administration has responded to NBC's decision. They object to it. They say that while the situation is very serious, neither Prime Minister Maliki nor we, meaning the Bush administration, believe Iraq is in a civil war. One of the arguments that people make is that, you know, there is an insurgency. It's not just two parties struggling for power. Al-Qaeda is involved. So what do you say in response to that? And why is it nonsense? Why would the Bush administration not want to call it a civil war if it is?
Well, I think there's a legitimate domestic political concern. The American people have walked away from this war as it is, and that they won't tolerate us staying to referee a domestic civil war in Iraq. That's what's going on. And clearly, we're going to come out in the coming 24 months, largely. We can't suppress this civil war in urban areas with U.S. combat troops. It's not just the casualties. It's the nature of the struggle. The Iraqis have to do it. They have not been adequately resourced to carry out that task. That's got to be our primary focus. As General John Abizade, our brilliant CENTCOM commander, has been articulating for the last couple of 3 years. He hasn't gotten the resources needed to equip, train, and deploy a robust Iraqi security presence.
Retired four-star Army General Barry McCaffrey. General McCaffrey, thank you.
Good to be with you, Robin.
Well, joining us with more, Yale Professor Nicholas Sambanis, author of Understanding Civil War, Evidence and Analysis. And Professor, do you agree with NBC's analysis that this in Iraq is a civil war?
Yes, it is. It has been a civil war pretty much since the handoff of sovereignty in the summer of 2004.
Well, the Bush administration also said today the violence is centered primarily around Baghdad and is not countrywide.
Yes. Well, that sounds strange to me, because usually when the fighting actually reaches the capital, then you know that you're in trouble.
And Professor, if you would, compare the Iraq war. What is another civil war that you think it closely resembles? Because some are saying, well, it's not a civil war. There's foreign fighters who have come in. It's not so clear-cut a division between two sides.
Well, most civil wars have extensive international intervention, actually. In Bosnia, there was direct intervention by Serbia, for example, assisting Bosnian Serbs, and Croatia assisting Croats fighting in Bosnia. The unique element here is the extensive intervention by Al-Qaeda and other terrorist entities.
We read that scholars in the U.S., such as yourself, agree that there have been at least 100 civil wars since 1945. You're quoted as saying there's a consensus among your fellow scholars that this indeed is one, and that the level of violence is so extreme in Iraq,
yes,
that it far surpasses most civil wars since 1945?
If compared to other wars of similar duration, yes. So the average civil war lasts between 5 and 6 years, and if we count from the beginning of the handover of sovereignty in 2004, then this civil war is actually in its early stages, and it has already killed, let's say, an average of about 40,000 people, and that is above the median level of deaths in a civil war. So if violence continues at these levels without even escalating for another 4 years, then it will certainly have surpassed most civil wars since 1945.
Yale Professor Nicholas Sambanis, also author of Understanding Civil War, Evidence and Analysis. Professor Sambanis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, staying with Iraq, Saddam Hussein's trial on genocide charges against the Kurds resumed today after a 19-day break. Zainab Salbi will be watching closely. You may remember we spoke with her about being called the pilot's daughter because her father was Saddam Hussein's pilot. Well, Zainab now runs Women for Women International, an organization that helps women in war zones. They've published a new book titled The Other Side of War, Women's Stories of Survival and Hope, because as Zainab writes, most casualties in war were once male soldiers. Now they are primarily civilians and mainly women. And Zainab Salvi joins us with their stories. Thanks so much.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, I do want to talk to you about the book and about the cause, Women to Women International. But first, about your thoughts on Saddam Hussein, because when we last spoke with you, his first war crimes trial was getting underway. Coincidentally, your first book, your memoir, Between Two Worlds, Escape from Tyranny, Growing Up in the Shadow of Saddam, had just come out. Fascinating read. I mean, I remember, for instance, the story of you as a teenager. I mean, you called him uncle as you were growing up. And there was always this sort of fear, you know, sort of low-grade fear about him. But, you know, at one point you went for a car ride with him. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, no, absolutely. My father, at the age when I was about 11 years old, was asked to be his pilot. And it's never possible to say no to Saddam. To say no was actually to be killed or to be punished severely. The whole family would be. And so the story of my life is how Saddam took over. He was like a poison gas leaking into our home, and we breathed him in slowly, and we resisted him slowly. Mm. But he changed my life in many ways, actually.
How so?
He captured us. You know, being close to the devil, I always say, meant that we were only closer to danger. It did not mean that we were safe from danger. During the day, I would go to a normal school. This is my parents resisted in small ways, you know, by refusing to send me to a palace school. And I would hear from my classmates how, you know, public executions were taking place in the streets of Iraq, and anybody who had a gun could just shoot at the executed man who was pinned to the wall. And at night, I would go to Saddam's parties or his daughter's parties, and they were completely isolated from the reality, or rather, obviously knew it and did not care. And we're living in a different world, and we were forced to smile when they smiled and be serious when they were serious, because not to do that, to show any expressions, was actually very dangerous for us.
Yeah. You implied in your memoir that Saddam Hussein himself used his power to take advantage of women to rape them. You implied that that happened to your mother. It was something sort of an unspoken. And it would have happened to you if you hadn't left Iraq.
He had a public day, for example. This is a day in which any person could go and ask for his advice and to solve private family issues. And most of the times, women would go to these days. I knew for a fact that a lot of times, many times when he saw a woman that he liked, he would take her to the other room and he would rape her. And I feel actually just talking about this violence against women that he personally committed, but his regime committed against women, this is one of the crimes that we should make sure that he gets prosecuted for. You know, as we read lately about the verdict he got, I feel there's no question Saddam is one of the worst criminals in recent history. But it's an unfortunate thing to kill him before a thorough prosecution of all his crimes, and particularly his crimes against women.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because the verdict in the first trial was death by hanging.
Right.
And it might mean that subsequent trials don't happen.
But exactly.
So that you're saying is bothersome to you, but what about the verdict itself, death by hanging?
You know, we need to evolve beyond Saddam. This trial is about the future of Iraq. This is an opportunity, a historical opportunity, to tell our truth, to seek our reconciliation, to document the past, and to learn about how to move forward in the future. Personally speaking, by executing Saddam, we would be repeating the exact same patterns that he created. You know, no one had a fair trial during Saddam's time. No one had a fair trial. And many, there are groups in Iraq, and it's an important group, we have to respect it, that doesn't feel that this is a fair trial. So I find it may, it's closing a chapter way too fast before thoroughly documenting it, and it will impact the history, the future of Iraq.
Well, turning to your book, in which you've, you know, this concern that you have for the women of Iraq, you've extended to women around the world who've been through some of the most, just paging through it, is difficult. These are survivors from Africa, Bosnia, Colombia. It is stomach-turning to see some of the things that have happened to these women. Now, obviously, you know, men are killed in war. Men who are soldiers are killed in war. What are some of the things that are compelling to you about what happens to women during war?
I think there are many compelling things, actually. First, we need to understand war from what I call the backline discussion. In the Western world, we often discuss war from a frontline discussion. That has everything to do with the troops and the weapons and the borders and the politics of war. But that discussion, while it is very true and very accurate, also ends with the signing of a peace agreement at one point of a war. What we are missing from the discussion is the backline discussion. I believe violence against women in wartime is actually very strategic, very organized. It's rarely random. It's there's a lot of implications of why women face violence. Mm-hmm. And you know, you conquer a land and you rape its women. You rape, pillage, and kill at the same time.
Well, you also write that women are a sort of a good indicator of the direction a country's going, that they become the first targets in Iraq. The women were the first to be kidnapped. You talk about how in Afghanistan they were the first target of the Taliban.
Absolutely. I feel women, I believe women are bellwether to the society. We are like the kitchen door to a house. When things enter through the kitchen door, no one notices, but it enters the house nevertheless. And the same thing when it comes to violence. Violence often actually starts through women, but everyone doesn't pay attention to it because we are still on the margin of the discussion, frankly. And the classic example for that is Taliban's usage of violence. They started with women. Everyone looked the other direction, said that this is their culture, this is their religion, this is whatever. Well, eventually every single man, woman, and child suffered in Afghanistan. Eventually the whole world suffered, and America particularly suffered. But also women lead to progress, and we need to watch what happens to women. When they progress, they take the whole society back up with them.
Yes, there's Jeanette, whose hands were cut off in Congo. Zainab Salbi tells their stories. We'll have more after the break. Stay with us Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with Zainab Salbi, whose first book, a memoir about growing up in Saddam Hussein's inner circle, came out last year. Her new book is titled The Other Side of War, Women's Stories of Survival and Hope, a book of photographs of women she's met. There's Jeanette, whose hands were cut off in Congo, Beta, who was macheted in Rwanda. These are women she met as founder of Women for Women International. And Zainab, in your new book, you tell the story of Nabido from Congo. You write that no one told you more about the power of telling one's story than she did. She'd been raped by 8 men who forced her sons to participate. One son shot when he refused. Her daughters raped in front of her eyes. Just a terrible story. And as she told it, her forearm, as you write, fluttered out of control. Why?
In the act of raping her, they also were cutting her all over her body. They broke her arm with the back of a gun or a pistol. But the thing is, it's not what Nabito only went through. And this is, as I was saying earlier, women are always victimized of war. What we don't discuss is how courageous they are. We really don't give them credit for their courage and resilience of picking up from that incredible violence and just keep on going. And what Nabito told me is that when I was sitting in front of that woman, who was 55 at the time I met her a few years ago, illiterate, homeless at the time, she had only one dress on, which she owned, And she told me, I'd never told anybody my story except you. And that's when I turned to her and I said, what should I do with your story? Should I keep it a secret or should I tell it to the whole world as I usually would? And she looks at me and she said, if I can tell the whole world about my story, I would, because that may stop other women from going through what I've been through. But I can't. You can. You go ahead and tell the story. And what I learned over and over, not only from Nabitu, but so many, is the power of courage.
Well, I have to jump in and say, she said to you, go ahead and tell the world about my story, just not the neighbors.
Yes.
She, because what, shame? She didn't...
Well, yes, because we are always afraid of the people we know. But the continuation of the story, actually, is that Nabitu went through our program. And the program entails matching her with someone in America or around the world by asking a sponsor to send $27 a month along with a letter to someone like Nabitu for a year to help her go through women's rights training and job skills training and to help her get a job. So when I met Nabitu a few months ago, actually, in Congo, she had bought a home. She had started a business of selling goods in the market. And she actually, while 3 years ago, I believe, when I first met her, was embarrassed to tell the neighbors, she became a popular figure
among the neighbors. Did she ever fix her arm? Because I'm still so struck with this image of, as she was talking to you, her arm was just sort of fluttering around because it had been broken so badly that it appeared she had a second elbow in her forearm.
Absolutely. She fixed her arms, and beside the starting of the business, she owns a land, which is a big deal. War, in my opinion, is like a flashlight on humanity. It shows you the worst of humanity, but it also shows you the best of humanity. And that letter and that money that comes from a strange woman saying, I care for you, becomes that goodness of humanity.
It's amazing when we read and are reminded that rape was only first prosecuted as a war crime after the genocide, the conflict between the Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda in 1998, then following that also in the former Yugoslavia.
Absolutely.
That's astonishing that it was only then a war crime.
And that's what speaks about courage, because rape has historically been used in wartime, from the rape of 900,000 German women in World War II by Russian soldiers to 400,000 Bangladeshi women in the independence war in 1971 to 20,000 Bosnian women to 500,000 Rwandese women in 94. But we usually stop. We usually die in our silence. And what women in Rwanda and in Bosnia did, which is a historical event, was they spoke out. They spoke, and because they spoke their truth and they told their truth, the world, we were able to lobby and to change the laws of international community.
It's, you know, for anyone who thinks, oh, this is just something that happens in some underdeveloped third world countries, it's amazing to see the pictures of, for instance, the Bosnian women, sophisticated, beautiful women in, you know, Western dress and educated.
Yes.
And what they went through. I mean, it's just, it's a reminder of Sinclair Lewis's title of his book. The title was It Can't Happen Here. It's a reminder it can. I'm just wondering, are there pictures, are there one or two that, you know, that stay with you, that maybe haunt you or give you hope?
Oh, they never haunt me. There is a lot of sorrow out there, but there's always resilience and beauty afterwards. There are many pictures. One of them is Honorata, who is featured actually in the book. And Honorata is from Congo. She is an educated woman. She's a principal of school. And one day, as she left her school, she was kidnapped. And she became a sexual slave for the rebels for a year and a half.
I'm looking at her picture right now.
And when we met her, she was homeless. She was sleeping every day in different people's home and all of these things. Her family had abandoned her, all of these things. She goes through our program. And I meet her again a few months ago, actually, in our center. And this, and Honorata, had established a cooperative. We taught her how to do batik fabric, and she's now doing batik fabric and clothes and selling it, making a living. She has at her own home. She's speaking with her family. But here is what's so amazing about her. On International Women's Day, we actually had a celebration, and we invited the men of the city we work in, the mayor and the governor and all of that. And she said, I want to give a speech to them. So she stood in front of them and said, pain and suffering has an ear, has an eye, and today it has a mouth, and I want to tell you what happens to it. And she started telling what happened to her in details in front of the governor. And she starts saying, you need to know this is happening to the women in here, and you need to stop it. You have a responsibility. We all were amazed at her courage. This is not an easy thing to do. But beyond that, Honoretta actually has been dedicating her life in the last year to encourage every single woman in her community to vote. So, you know, I can stop at Honoretta's story and just see her as a victim, or I can continue it and see her as really an inspiration for me.
Zainab, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to seeing what next time will bring.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Zainab Salbi, founder and CEO of the group Women for Women International. Her new book is The Other Side of War, Women's Stories of Survival and Hope. Her memoir, Between Two Worlds, Escape from Tyranny, Growing Up in the Shadow of Saddam, comes out in paperback this summer. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. For now, stay with us. Much more ahead, including later in the program, the music of Jimi Hendrix. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Pope Benedict begins a four-day trip to Turkey tomorrow, but he won't be welcome everywhere. Yesterday, nearly 25,000 Turks in Istanbul protested the Pope's trip. The Pope infuriated many in predominantly Muslim Turkey by giving a speech a few months ago, quoting a Christian Byzantine emperor who linked Islam with violence. And the Pope has also spoken out against Turkey, a secular democracy, joining the European Union. Well, joining us on the line from Riga, Latvia, where he'll be attending a NATO summit, is Suat Kanikliaglu. He's director of the German Marshall Fund of the U.S., but he has some reflections on his home country, Turkey. And Suat, welcome.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about the mood in Turkey. The Pope attempted to put his comments last September in the context that he was making a speech about how he feared that Europe had drifted too far from its Christian roots. How are Turks and Muslims in particular, you know, feeling about the Pope's comments?
You know, one thing that's little known in the West is really that actually before the Pope, you know, Professor Ratzinger became Pope, you know, his remarks about Turkey's EU membership potential were already circulating in the Turkish media way before he became, when it became obvious that he was one of the candidates, to succeed Pope John Paul.
Right. When he was cardinal, as Cardinal Ratzinger, the now Pope said, Turkey has always represented a different continent in permanent contrast to Europe. And if Turkey does achieve its bid to become a member of the European Union, it will be the first Muslim nation to do so.
Yes. And when he became Pope and, you know, those unfortunate remarks in September, it sort of added to the already, you know, present suspicion about the Pope's views on Turkey to quite an extent. And I think we've seen in the last couple of days some more positive signs. For instance, yesterday, you know, protests were in Istanbul, but the expectation was, for instance, that there would be 75 to 80,000 people to come to this, but, you know, hardly 20,000 people made it there. And there's also a growing awareness in Turkey that this is an important visit, and that Turkey should exhibit its traditional hospitality to the Pope. The primary objective of this visit is to meet with the Orthodox Patriarch in Istanbul. And, you know, the Pope's agenda from his, you know, very beginning is really to unite the Christian world. A lot of people in Turkey, and I think also in the Western media, you know, want to interpret this visit as a sort of fence-mending mission between Christianity and Islam, and Turkey is obviously an ideal country to do this.
Because there's a very small Christian minority in Turkey.
That's true. However, you know, the Orthodox Patriarchate is located in Istanbul. It carries huge significance for the Orthodox world. And I think that the primary aim of this visit is really between Christians.
What do some of the more devout Muslims fear about the Pope visiting Christians there? Do they fear that he's perhaps trying to make more inroads for Christianity in Turkey?
Yes, some missionary activities in Turkey are viewed very suspiciously, and this dates back to the late Ottoman Empire when a lot of missionaries were active in the East and working with the Armenians and those unfortunate events of World War One. But also, a lot of symbolism is attached to this. I mean, the Pope will be visiting the Hagia Sophia, which is used to be a very prominent Byzantine church, and then was converted into a mosque and then a museum. There is some symbolism attached to it, whether he will pray in what is now a museum, the Hagia Sophia. All of this is very symbolic, and given the atmosphere at the global atmosphere right now between Christianity and Islam, obviously you have a lot of people in Turkey who can exploit these things with a devout sort of public. And please don't forget, we are entering in an election cycle in Turkey, which is rather contested, and there is a huge confrontation, domestic political confrontation between those who want Islam to play a larger role in Turkish society and those who value the Turkey's secular system that has been working for the last 8 decades.
The Pope is also expected to visit the Blue Mosque in Turkey. It will be his first stop ever at a Muslim place of worship. How provocative is that going to be, or healing? Which do you think it's going to be?
I think it's a very healthy and constructive change in his program. I think a lot of Turks welcome that he actually will visit the Blue Mosque. It is a beautiful mosque and carries huge significance in Istanbul, especially among the devout. I think also one recent change, which I just found out from my friends in Ankara, is that the Pope will also meet with Prime Minister Erdogan. And tomorrow, a 20-minute meeting has been scheduled at the Ankara airport. Earlier on, there were some speculations that many Turkish politicians were avoiding the Pope. But now this recent change in the program and also the visit to the mosque really indicate that both sides want a successful visit to come out of this.
The Turkish government is described as rigidly secular. Muslim women, for instance, are banned from wearing headscarves. But we're reading that there's concern that the Pope's comments and coupled with his visit might radicalize the huge number of, they call themselves, I understand, identity card Muslims. They are not as devout as the fundamentalists. They do want to join the European Union as opposed to some fundamentalist Muslims who want to join a union with only, Muslim countries. So how much is the Pope impacting these more secular Muslims and the divide between Muslims and Turkey?
One of the reasons why the Pope's comments back in September, received such huge attention in Turkey is because Turkey is a moderate country. It's secular, and it represents the moderate wing of Islam and how it is practiced within a democracy. And, comments such as those were made in September really put in jeopardy those, especially countries like Turkey, who represent the moderate wing of Islam. Islam is not one uniform group of people who practice the religion in the same manner. Mm-hmm. And, the anxiety about such confrontational comments comes especially from those secular and more moderate Muslims who are intend to make the values of this religion work with the values of a pluralist democracy. And I think this should be viewed in this respect, and I understand the Pope has now a much better and more sober understanding of what sort of impact such comments may have, and I hope that the visit in itself will actually contribute to some more cordial understanding between the two religions.
Suat Kanikliaglu, director of the German Marshall Fund of the U.S. and also a Turk, commenting on the Pope's upcoming visit to his country. Suat, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Robin.
And this quick note, as we said, Turkey's prime minister announced today that he will meet the Pope at the airport in Ankara for about 20 minutes tomorrow as the Pope arrives and as the prime minister departs for Riga, Latvia, where Suat is, and where NATO is holding a summit. Now, high on the agenda for that meeting is Afghanistan. President Bush will try to convince Turkey and other nations to move their troops in Afghanistan from the relatively peaceful north of the country to the south to help fight the Taliban. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. One of the 50 newly elected Democrats in Congress has had an unusual career. In addition to being an attorney, Paul Hodes of New Hampshire is a musician. With his wife, Pego, Hodes writes and performs what he calls music that children and families can enjoy. Well, he's also written an opera about Oscar Wilde, the flamboyant 19th century Irish writer who was sent to prison for his homosexuality. We featured it on Here and Now earlier this year.
We'll put him away in Old Bailey's dock, and when we see him, he'll die of shock.
Well, we recently reached Paul Hodes in the halls of Congress and asked him if he felt any tension between his new line of work in Washington, his family-oriented music, and an opera about gay lovers.
Not at all. The arts illuminate the truth of the soul, and there's a broad range of artistic expression. And I tend to try to bring a creative approach to problem solving, partly due to my arts background, partly due to my legal background. So for me, it's all really a seamless whole.
Here Now's Lynn Menegon spoke with several of the people involved with the creation of Oscar Wilde and opera in two acts. She began with the composer Thomas Oboe Lee.
You know, I'm actually very surprised that nobody else has written an opera on Oscar Wilde, this unique individual during Victorian London. And he himself was one man against entire society. And that kind of character, to me, is definitely operatic.
Like a hyacinth on a sofa, so white and gold, so white and gold. Like a platter of finest china, so blue and white, so blue and white.
You've talked about controversy in the topic, but the music is very melodic and very lush and romantic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up listening to Gershwin, I grew up listening to Cole Porter, Rodgers and Hammerstein are my heroes. So I want an opera that's gonna have tunes that people can relate to, that can they can attach to it emotionally.
My love for you is blue and white, the wonder of my white hot night.
And also, Oscar Wilde was a love story between Oscar and Alfred Bosley Douglas. To me, most great operas is all about love. What we're trying to do is write a love story.
My love for you is blue and white. I hold your smooth young body tight.
I'm David Kravitz.
And you are?
Oscar Wilde.
How did you approach the topic of Oscar Wilde? Because it is a controversial one in some circles. And you have to sing lines like, when men could be men with boys in their prime. And I hold your smooth young body tight.
You sort of can't worry about the fact that it may be controversial. I mean, that's for other people to worry about. That's not my problem. My problem is to take the character of Oscar Wilde and as much as I can learn about him and bring to him in my sort of portrayal of him. And put it out there. And it's for others to judge whether it's controversial or anything like that.
I'm Phil Laureate, Artistic Director of Granite State Opera. I hadn't really planned on making a political statement. It was a great subject in that there are all these passions that are going on in it. And, you know, passion between two people, passion between Bosie's father when he comes in and is condemning Oscar for seducing his son when actually it was the other way around. There's that passion. And that's something that opera does incredibly well, is it brings out – it's a way to express the passions that you can't get very easily in spoken dialogue.
Brooding cloud out of a tawny mane of drift.
And I think – and I hope that this opera will change some minds. An audience will see a man who was a good person. You know, he lived on a very high moral standard, yet he was ostracized for being different. We're just presenting his life as it is.
Composer Thomas Oboe Lee on Oscar Wilde and opera in two acts. Congressman-elect from New Hampshire Paul Hodes is the librettist, and as far as we know, the first ever librettist in Congress. Stay with us. The music of Jimi Hendrix is ahead. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Jimi Hendrix exploded onto the pop scene in London in 1966. By 1968, he was a major star. That spring, he returned to New York to record what would be his third and final album with the Jimi Hendrix Experience, Electric Ladyland. Widely considered to be his masterpiece, the final cut was called Voodoo Child Slight Return. Well, Here Now's jazz and blues aficionado James Isaacs joins us now to sing the praises of Voodoo Child, which he considers a milestone recording. James, a very big welcome to you today.
Hi, Robin. Glad to hear it.
Exactly where and when was Voodoo Child Slight Return recorded? What are the roots of it?
Okay. Voodoo Child, Slight Return was recorded at the Record Plant on West 44th Street in New York City on May 3rd, 1968. And the reason that we must refer to the full title Voodoo Child, Slight Return is because on the previous day, Hendrix recorded a much longer, slower variation on its theme, simply called Voodoo Child, C-H-I-L-E.
Say my heroes are made of desire. Far away as Jupiter, sulfur mine, way down by the Nipping Sea. I have a hummingbird that hums so loud. You think you are losing your mind.
That's a snippet of Voodoo Child, and Robin asked you a question about the roots of this and Voodoo Child, Slight Return. We go back to March 28, 1941, when an obscure Mississippi country blues man named Robert Petway recorded his Catfish Blues.
What if I want a catfish, mama? I said swimming deep down in the blue sea.
Okay, so now we move forward to February 1950. We're still in Chicago, and there, another transplanted Mississippi bluesman has a go at catfish blues. This artist's name is McKinley Morganfield, but at this time, he's beginning to gain fame as Muddy Waters. And although he opens the performance with the lines, "Well, I wish I was a catfish swimming in the deep blue sea," Muddy Waters called his blues in the key of E, Rolling Stone.
And from there, the Rolling Stones took their name.
That's absolutely right.
What a story.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Okay, on the Muddy Waters recording, he really sets down that hypnotic drone. It's pretty much the same guitar figure that Hendrix deploys in Voodoo Child, Slight Return. All right, here's Muddy, Rolling Stone.
I went to my baby's house, and I sat down,
we can see, you know, a little bit of its birthing.
Oh, absolutely.
But then what did he do to make it so remarkable?
Okay, well, Robin, if Robert Petway's Catfish Blues is a horse and buggy and Muddy Waters' Rolling Stone is a car, I'm going to think about this for a second. If it's a car that's certainly beyond a Model T, but not yet an Olds Rocket 88, Jimi Hendrix's Voodoo Child Slight Return is an interstellar spaceship, because what Hendrix did was transport the blues from West Africa and the Mississippi Delta and the nighttime streets of Chicago's South Side and West Side to the outskirts of infinity. And that's a phrase from his lyric to Voodoo Child.
I take it you like it.
Yeah, just a little.
Yeah, just a little. Keep going.
You'll notice that Hendrix loves to play his guitar in unison with his singing voice. This is a device that's old as dirt and frequently used by the country blues pioneers. But no one uses it to greater effect than Jimi Hendrix.
You know, what an image. You know, it's this wonderful image of Hendrix standing next to a mountain, chopping it down with the edge of his hand.
Well, think Paul Bunyan and his axe. This is all very much in the American folkloric tradition of big, mythical characters accomplishing impossible feats. And as a kid in Seattle, he loved to read comic books about the exploits of various superheroes. Eventually, of course, Jimi Hendrix became the superhero of the electric guitar.
Let's talk a little bit about the way Hendrix played the guitar. What was it that set him apart for you?
Well, Robin, for me, there's a great big difference between talent and genius, and Hendrix was a genius on his instrument. I want to take you to near the end of the solo when Hendrix's guitar emits the scream. Mm-hmm. Now, you know the famous 1893 painting by the Norwegian artist Edvard Munch.
I'm doing it right now in the studio with
okay.
my mouth open.
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay, actually the painting is just called Scream. Hendrix's scream, bending a note in the upper register, always calls to mind Edvard Munch's androgynous creature screaming in horror on a bridge against a red sky. Some of the greatest of all jazz players possessed the gift of the scream. Charlie Parker had it, John Coltrane had it, Ornette Coleman also immediately comes to mind.
Oh boy. So, you know, what is it that you like most about Voodoo Child?
Everything.
You know, we heard about how he would, you know, play the guitar with his teeth and stuff.
Behind his head, between his legs, very occasionally setting it on fire. I never saw him do that. So on the one hand, this is part of the grand tradition of black showmanship, and there are few greater showmen than Hendrix. Well, James Brown comes to mind immediately. Hendrix's management, however, wanted a wild stage act. They wanted him to be, I hate to say it, you know, like a carnival freak mm-hmm. or something, and a sexual shaman who appealed mostly to white suburban kids. That was the bread and butter of the Jimi Hendrix experience, you mm-hmm. know. But Hendrix was an incredible improvising artist, and his holy grail was the blues. That is what's at the core of Voodoo Child's Slight Return.
Well, now, James, you've told me that Jimi Hendrix's second vocal chorus is the key to the song.
It is to me, Robin, because first he apologizes for taking up all your sweet time. I'll give it right back to you one of these days. Then after he sings those lines, well, he forecasts his own death. Hmm. Here's the kicker. He sings, "If I don't meet you no more in this world, I'll meet you on the next one, not in the next one, and don't be late." In other words, this guy doesn't think he's going to heaven or hell. He thinks he's going maybe to Jupiter or the rings of Saturn or somewhere far, far away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe this is just so much cosmic slop, but I, for one, believe him every time I hear him sing those lines. On September 18, 1970, he died in London at age 27. On November 27, 2006, Hendrix would have turned 64. We won't see him no more in this world, at least in the flesh, but if the gods smile upon me, perhaps I'll meet him on the next one. I swear I won't be late.
Here now is jazz and blues aficionado James Isaacs, remembering one of the greatest musicians of the past century, Jimi Hendrix, and obviously a personal and continuing favorite to you.
Absolutely.
James, you're going to see him on the Rings of Saturn.
If I'm lucky, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.